This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abra. Coming up on the program, unrest erupts in the West Bank as the death toll in Gaza approaches 1,000. New Yorkers once again question zero-tolerance policies after a local man dies in police custody. And Nigerians mark 100 days since the mass kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has submitted a ceasefire proposal to Hamas and the Israeli government. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Kerry's proposal would allow Israeli ground troops to occupy Gaza for the duration of a one-week ceasefire, ostensibly to look for and destroy tunnels used by militants. Protests in the West Bank grew Thursday night as tens of thousands marched toward Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque on the last night of Ramadan, known as the Night of Power. At least two people died. Anna Ferencevich joins us from Bethlehem. Anna, today there was a call for a day of rage. What happened in the West Bank?
Thus far in the West Bank, today in the afternoon, three Palestinians so far have been killed in clashes with Israelis again over demonstrations over the Gaza incursions. We believe tonight is going to be incredibly violent. We believe the violence is not going to subside, and we believe that tonight may be one of the most violent nights we have seen in years in the West Bank.
Smaller-scale protests and clashes have been ongoing in the area since mid-June, when three Israeli teens were kidnapped and killed, and then a Palestinian teen was kidnapped and killed in what some call an act of revenge. How were the protests last night different?
Palestinians in the West Bank have finally had enough, not just over the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, but we believe that because of the Gaza incursion, it is what we, I guess, would say the straw that broke the camel's back.
Was the tone last night different than in the days before?
Last night, you could hear people in the streets that were in this protest chanting "Intifada, Intifada, Intifada." So this significance really does underscore, I think, perhaps a turning point in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
That was West Bank journalist Anna Ferencevich. She spoke with FSRN on the phone earlier Friday. More than 800 Palestinians, most of them civilians, including many women and children, have been killed in Gaza since the Israeli military launched the so-called Operation Protective Edge. More than 30 Israelis are dead, mostly soldiers, since the onset of the ground offensive. FSRN's Rami El-Maghari is in the Nuzarat area of Gaza. He joined us to discuss events there and how he and his family are faring.
Sounds speak for themselves, actually. As I'm right now speaking to you, amidst the sound of the Israeli drone and sounds of bombings nearby and gunfire, very loud gunfire by the Israelis, just about a few kilometers away from where I'm staying, the movement is very scary and very risky. The death toll is increasing by the minute in the territory, and the injured people also are increasing. Hundreds of people are injured every day, tens of others are killed every day, and the Israeli escalation on the ground is continuing unabated.
The United Nations said this week that more than 110,000 children in Gaza need psychosocial support as a direct result of the violence. How is your family faring?
Oh, that's a very good question. I have been talking to myself, talking to some people that I'm living with, that these children, let them to express themselves. Do not stop them from playing around in the house. Do not stop them from shouting even, because they are really in a very tense situation. They want to play. They want to have a better day. Yani, I tell you something. One of my nephews, 8-year-old, he has his birthday yesterday. We in the house, in the family, we could not celebrate his birthday. We have about here in this house about 30 family members who are very closely connected as relatives. All of them cannot have these children live very normally or live at least some sort of happily. I just still live everybody here to let these children to scream, to shout, to go wherever they want, to play around. Do not stop them.
Rami El-Maghari spoke with us from Gaza after being forced from his home in the Maghazi refugee camp with his wife and four children. Many residents of Gaza are taking up shelter in schools run by UNRWA, the United Nations Aid Agency for Palestinians. Those shelters have themselves been the target of attacks. UNRWA today strongly condemned what was the fourth hit to a UN shelter in the past 4 days. At least 17 people inside the building were killed. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You'll find more of our work, along with information about how you can support it, at fsrn.org. Funeral services were held this week for Eric Garner, an African-American man who died while he was being arrested by New York police officers in Staten Island. New York City community activists and elected officials are demanding a thorough and swift investigation. The incident was captured on video, which went viral, and shows officers using a chokehold, an arrest method banned by the NYPD for more than 2 decades. For FSRN, Rebecca Miles has more.
Michael Stewart, Mark Davison.
At a gathering in front of New York City Hall this week, City Council member Andy King read out a list of names of people who have died or been brutalized while being arrested or held in custody by the New York City Police Department. King is the co-chair of the City Council's Black, Latino, and Asian Caucus. His remarks came after the sudden death on July 17th of Eric Garner, an African-American, during his arrest by the NYPD for the sale of untaxed cigarettes. Police say Garner, a father and grandfather from Staten Island, died of a heart attack as officers tried to arrest him. Video of the incident, however, shows an officer putting him in a chokehold from behind as other officers pile on. Garner can be heard gasping, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." It's those words that Staten Island City Council member Debbie Rose found particularly disturbing.
Did they not hear what the whole world heard? The constrained cries of, I can't breathe, over and over and over until there wasn't any more. These images are etched in my mind, denying me peace of mind. And once again, our communities mourn, not only for the loss of life of Eric Garner, but also once again, we are reminded of how little value our lives have.
The NYPD 2013 Patrolman's Guide bans the use of chokeholds. At a press conference the day after Garner's death, Mayor Bill de Blasio appeared with NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton and said he'll be conducting a full investigation with Staten Island District Attorney Daniel Donovan. The mayor said, quote, "I was very troubled by the video. It's too early to jump to conclusions. We must wait for the full facts," end quote. The Black, Latino, and Asian caucus say they want a quick investigation and resolution within months, not several years. Both officers involved in the initial arrest are on desk assignment, and one had his badge and gun removed pending the investigation. Some say this will be a litmus test for the de Blasio administration. Brooklyn City Council member Jemani Williams.
Make no doubt about it, was elected in a large part from the Black community and the Latino community precisely because of what they said, how they would deal with the police community relations in the city of New York.
At an earlier rally this week, community activists demanded Commissioner Bratton step down and an end to his so-called broken windows policing. According to theory, broken windows in a neighborhood are symptoms of petty crime, and if police don't intervene aggressively to prevent them, crime will escalate. It was this theory that Bratton put into practice when he became NYPD commissioner under Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. It led to zero tolerance policies for petty offenses and the implementation of the stop and frisk practice of physical searches of individuals with little to no probable cause. Arrests for panhandling, turnstile jumping, and vandalism increased, as did complaints of police brutality. David Galassa from the Justice Committee for the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights says little has changed to improve the ways NYPD interacts with the city's communities of color.
To think that Bill de Blasio's first appointment was Bill Bratton, communities of color screamed out saying, no, this is not the wisest appointment at the time, and he still went ahead with it anyway. Now we see what happened 6 months later, 6, 7 months later. We have the killing of an innocent man. Bill Bratton's got to be held accountable or he's got to go.
Eric Garner was buried Wednesday. The medical examiner has yet to release its autopsy results. Since zero-tolerance policies took effect in New York more than 20 years ago, 200 people have died in interactions with the police, according to figures from Stolen Lives Project. But what is unknown is how many police have lost their job as a result. Rebecca Miles, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
36 people, homeless residents of New Haven, Connecticut, and their supporters, marched 10 blocks from a Catholic worker house of hospitality to an empty city lot in a low-income neighborhood to set up a second tent encampment. They're hoping to pressure the city into providing more housing and to stop criminalizing those who try to sleep outdoors. But they expect that officials will order the camp's removal late Friday. New Haven is among many cities nationwide that have laws on the books aimed at the homeless population. Some cities go so far as to make it illegal to simply sit or lie down in certain places. Meanwhile, New Haven spends more than any other city in Connecticut on services for the homeless. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Where then shall we go? Where then shall we go?
Carrying signs that read, "It's not a crime to be homeless," and "The emergency starts tonight," more than 30 people gathered for some inspiration before heading off towards an empty lot in New Haven's Hill neighborhood. Floyd Rico Jones, who identifies as homeless, said violence is one of the risks frequently faced by the homeless population.
The idea of this right here is to sit back and give someone a place to go without having a problem from the police or anyone else. It's just to make sure that someone else has somewhere safe to live so they can sit back and have a clean atmosphere, a safe place for their stuff to be, and a safe place for them to sit back and live without fear of somebody else hurting them.
Marchers arrived at a fenced-in empty lot between two triple-decker houses. There was no gate, so people streamed in, one pushing a lawnmower to cut the grass while others trimmed back the bushes. They carried out an old couch and a living room chair. Then they set up tents and held a community meeting. Martha Okafor is the city's community services administrator and the point person on homeless issues. She said New Haven budgets more than $1 million a year on services for the homeless, more than any other city in the state and over and above the budgets of direct service organizations. She disagrees that the ban on sleeping outside on public property criminalizes homelessness.
We at the City Hall do not believe in criminalization of people that are homeless. So that is the reason why we have partnership addressing the issue around homelessness. The people that are staying outside, the question is really how many of them are truly homeless.
Okafor says only 3 people accepted an offer of beds at homeless shelters after a similar protest in May. Some homeless people prefer to avoid shelters because of the rules in place at many of them or the fear of living in unsupportive close quarters. Melinda Tuhus, Free Speech Radio News, New Haven.
If you eat meat produced in the United States, chances are it came from livestock that spent at least part of its life at a confined animal feeding operation or factory farm. As these enormous feedlots have become more common, public oversight has weakened, largely thanks to so-called ag-gag laws. Will Potter is an investigative journalist and author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. He spoke with FSRN's Shannon Young about ag-gag laws and a creative crowdfunding campaign to monitor factory farms from the sky.
First, can you explain what the ag-gag is for those unfamiliar with the term?
Ag-gag bills refer to a series of legislation introduced across the country that make it illegal to photograph or videotape animal abuse on factory farms and slaughterhouses. And the bills are being pushed by the agriculture industry in response to a series of investigations by groups like the Humane Society that have exposed horrific animal welfare abuses on these farms. And on top of that, these ag-gag bills are now expanding to additional attacks on whistleblowers and journalists. Now they're expanding to other countries as well.
The legislation you mentioned, is it state level or federal?
These are state bills. So there are about 6 states that have passed these into law right now. But in my research, what I've found is that identical language is popping up from state to state. In some cases, literally copying and pasting bits of legislation and reintroducing it. Now we're also seeing that in Australia as well. The industry there is wanting to copy and paste U.S.-style ag-gag laws and introduce them. But what's most, I think, concerning on the state level is that automatically brings to mind groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. So as I was digging into this, I found a model bill from 2003 called the Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act that ALEC created. And the way that groups like ALEC work is they make these model bills and then they share them among different state lawmakers and then introduce them without telling anyone that these were actually drafted by corporations. And this model bill isn't just ag-gag, it's kind of a wish list for everything that these industries want to criminalize animal and environmental protest groups. But undercover video is a big part of that.
Have there been any First Amendment constitutional challenges brought against these ag-gag bills?
There are two lawsuits right now in Idaho and in Utah, and I'm a plaintiff in both of these. And these are the first constitutional challenges to ag-gag laws. And I'm involved as a journalist for a couple of reasons. Exactly like you said, these are constitutional issues. They're putting not just me as a reporter, but they're also putting my sources at risk. And on top of that, these laws are unconstitutional because they're singling out one viewpoint to criminalize. Only video footage and photography that's critical is going to be under attack. And that's simply not allowable under the Constitution. And I'm really proud to say that now we have 16 different professional journalism groups that have signed on in support of my position and in support of this lawsuit, I should say, challenging ag-gag as a threat to journalism. And it's still really early in these challenges, but I think things are looking a bit promising.
In the meantime, you've developed a creative workaround. You launched a now fully funded Kickstarter campaign to cover the conditions in factory farms. What are you trying to accomplish with this?
So as I've been immersed the last few years in these ag-gag bills and watching how journalism and you know, media in general is being criminalized, it really got me thinking of how we could be more creative as journalists, as a profession in news gathering. If they're attempting to shut down different outlets to information and criminalize our sources, that just means we have to get a little bit more ambitious in finding new ways to gather information. And so I decided, well, what if I bought a drone? And not the kind of drone that the Obama administration is using to kill people. I mean, these are just simply remote-controlled aerial devices that have high-def cameras and can get around some of this ag-gag legislation. And I think more importantly, really expand the discussion that's taking place about privacy, about corporations having the right to hide what they're doing from consumers and from the government and the public. And I'm really overwhelmed by the response. I mean, it was fully funded. The Kickstarter was fully funded in just 5 days. And so I started working with journalists and photographers to expand it to other states, to other tactics that we could use. And then that expanded goal was fully funded as well. And so the response has just been overwhelming. I'm excited to see what the industry is exactly trying to hide here.
Will Potter is an investigative journalist and author of the book Green is the New Red. He joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
More than 100 days have passed since members of Boko Haram abducted more than 200 schoolgirls in northeastern Nigeria. Relatives of the girls are struggling to keep the issue in the public eye as the situation on the ground in Chibok province deteriorates. Ongoing attacks there have forced many to flee, either to the bush or to Nigerian cities. The displaced want Nigerian authorities to rescue the girls and to ensure safety for residents of Chibok and other vulnerable communities. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports.
3 months ago, members of the terrorist sect Boko Haram forced their way into school dormitories in the northern Nigerian town of Chibok and abducted almost 300 girls. According to a presidential committee, 57 escaped, while 219 remained missing. The schoolgirl's abduction inspired street protests along with a global online campaign forcing the government to accept help from foreign countries to find and free the girls. At a rally Tuesday in Lagos, rights advocates groups raised concerns about deteriorating security since the girls' kidnapping. Doris Yaro runs the group Kabasawa and said people hardly live in their houses because of fear of terrorist attacks.
You see people living in bush, sleeping in bush. Once it's like 5 o'clock, they will leave their houses. Those that their houses are still standing, they will go to the bush to sleep in order to avoid attack or being killed.
Kaka Ibrahim lives in Chibok, where she says children are increasingly orphaned.
Some house, you will enter, you will only see only the children. They don't know what happens. They cry. They are calling their mother. That it's not. She's not there. They killed her. They are calling the father. It's not there. They killed her. Chibok area now is the most vulnerable place now. Every village, day and night, they are sleeping in the bush.
Human rights groups are calling for safe camps.
These displaced people will need shelter for them.
Yaya Chiwa says Nigerian authorities need to find a way of helping the helpless. Three of his nieces were among the girls kidnapped.
Government can now come in, bring in medical facilities to take care of the sick people, bring in food, bring in clothes, and bring in people that can talk to them. Those people that are traumatized, they can talk to them. The parents of these girls, particularly, some are very sick. They need medical attention.
Boko Haram, an extremist group fighting for an Islamic State, has carried out a wave of bombings and assassinations in Nigeria since it launched a brutal insurgency in 2009. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
For the first time in Indonesia's democratic history, the country has a president who is from neither the military nor the political elite. Official election results released this week show Joko Widodo won with 53%. That's 8 million more votes than his opponent, Prabowo Subianto. From Jakarta, Rebecca Hinchke reports that many see this as a turning point for the country.
In Indonesia's 16 years of democracy, the faces on the ballot have been dominated by military and political elites. 40-year-old musician Marzuki Muhammad voted for the first time in this election. In the past, he, like many of his generation, didn't feel as if there was anyone to vote for. But in Joko Widodo, he saw someone he could believe in. Ayo kawan dukung Jokowi kala, bersatu padu coblos nomor dua. Marzuki wrote this rap about the candidate that became a theme song for Jokowi supporters.
This election was crucial. It was historic. I, like most people, feel exhausted and sick of our democracy being dominated by the elite. This is our chance to fight against the corrupt elite and return democracy to the people.
Marzuki says he was also deeply worried about a victory for the rival candidate, Prabowo Subianto, a former general who commanded the army's special forces under Suharto's dictatorship. Prabowo was fired from the military for kidnapping student activists in the 1990s during the final days of Suharto's rule. Prabowo Subianto's campaign was funded by two of Indonesia's wealthiest men, Prabowo's brother and Golkar Party chairman Abu Rizal Bakri. In contrast, Jokowi's campaign was largely funded by a large number of individual donors, a first for an Indonesian presidential election. Historian and respected author Gunawan Muhammad says he's never seen people so intensely involved in politics.
The people who put their money, their time, their energy into this idea of voting for Jokowi, which is not very clear idea, but the sentiment is there. How people sacrifice themselves for a common cause, which is unusual after so many years of cynicism. If I have to die tomorrow, I'm happy to see this.
Jokowi's playing down his election victory. On board a traditional boat in Jakarta's historic harbour, he called for national unity.
Jokowi Toto dan Yusuf Kala,
menyerukan kepada saudara-saudara sebangsa dan setanah air.
We are telling you it's time to unite as an Indonesian nation once again. You now need to repair the damaged relationships within families, between friends, and heal divisions that have been created in the workplace.
Hubungan tetangga dengan tetangga, hubungan teman dengan teman yang sempat renggang.
The election has been the most divisive in Indonesia's democratic history. Prabowo ran an effective and slick campaign, and Jokowi has won by only a margin of 7%. Shortly before the official results were announced, Prabowo Subianto said he was withdrawing from the count, calling the process flawed.
Telah terjadi kecurangan yang masif, terstruktur.
There was massive structural and systematic cheating during the 2014 election. We will exercise our constitutional right to reject the presidential election and declare it unconstitutional.
Listening in the front row is Ibu Wani and her husband. They are dressed in the national colors of red and white, and their five-year-old son is wearing full military uniform and Prabowo pins. She says her family would not accept Jokowi as their president.
He is not fit to be president. Just look at this face. He looks like an ordinary person off the street. He hasn't served or fought for his nation. He was just brought from the village to the city. The only person who is ready to sacrifice himself for the good of the nation is Pak Prabowo.
Under Indonesia's election laws, Prabowo now has the right to lodge a legal challenge in the Constitutional Court. While there have been some documented cases of irregularities, most international observers have declared the election free and fair. And for the first time, the Election Commission made all the vote tallying forms from the thousands of polling stations publicly available on their official website. A crowdsourced oversight project, Kawam Pemilu, attracted some 700 volunteers. They have been downloading the forms and doing their own count. Wandi Tuturong works as a consultant in Jakarta's financial district. During his free time, he's been monitoring the vote.
Yeah, because now everybody can participate. Everybody can see, everybody can participate, everybody can make their own counting. If the result is wins Jokowi or Prabowo, everybody will accept because they know the process. There is no black box anymore.
All eyes are now on Joko Widodo, a man who was raised in a bamboo shack in a riverbank slum, now president-elect of one of the world's largest democracies. He now has the difficult task of first uniting the nation of 250 million people before tackling issues such as rampant corruption, high unemployment, and Indonesia's crumbling infrastructure. Rebecca Henschke, Free Speech Radio News, Jakarta.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. For more information, please visit our website at fsrn.org. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.